ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Are you curious what ABC journalists are covering on the business beat?
All of the big tech companies have invested huge amounts of money in artificial intelligence.
Catch me, Carrington Clark, in conversation with my colleagues as we unpack tax policy, trade deals, and whether we should be worried about a tech bubble.
It's a very crucial time right now for them to try to turn the amount of money that they've invested into some kind of returns.
Find ABC Business Daily every Monday through Thursday on ABC Listen, or wherever you get your podcasts.
We now have a crisis of the system. It's more difficult for governments, whether they're coalition governments or Labor governments, to deliver proper national interest policy for the country. The coalition lost its way. It was attempting to respond to the changes going on in the country, but it was divided.
Which of these three prime ministers do you think best understood the challenges that Australia faces?
Each of these prime ministers disappointed.
Paul, if the political model is broken, how has Anthony Albanese managed to succeed politically? It's been one of the main political stories of the year. The rise of One Nation, largely at the expense of the Liberal and National parties, transforming the political landscape. Why has it happened? Well, there are obvious points which have contributed to the shift in voter sentiment, whether it was the defection of Barnaby Joyce, the Bondi terrorist attack, and of course the ongoing cost of living frustrations in the electorate. But the Liberal Party's vulnerability hasn't just come out of the blue. Even before voters started shifting to One Nation on the right, the Liberal Party was already losing them on the left to the Teal independents, and it was struggling with a crisis of conviction. So what's happened? How's this happened? How's the Liberal Party found itself in this position of weakness? Well, the eminent journalist and political historian Paul Kelly argues the party steadily lost its long-standing connection with the Australian electorate during its time in government under Tony Abbott, Malcolm Turnbull, and then Scott Morrison. His new book, The Twilight of Exceptionalism, covers the period of the coalition's time in office from 2013 to 2022, and it's the third and final in a remarkable series from the Australian newspaper's editor-at-large. Yes, this book was launched a couple of weeks ago, but we've had a few things on and didn't want to miss the opportunity for this conversation. I'm David Spears on Ngunnawal Country at Parliament House in Canberra. Welcome to Insiders on Background. Paul Kelly, welcome to you and congratulations on the book.
David, thank you so much, and it's great to be with you.
Well, let's start perhaps with the title, The Twilight of Exceptionalism. It seems to me this isn't a reflection just on the quality of the leaders during this period of coalition government. It seems to me you're reflecting as well on Australia as a whole in this book and how we've changed and how we've become a more divided and perhaps less exceptional nation. Is that fair?
That's exactly correct, David. What I argue in the book is that Australia once had a period of true exceptionalism when we led the world in terms of economic and social reform, and the statistics indicated that. This was the period of Hawke, Keating, Howard and Costello, when you had reformist governments from both sides of politics pioneering a new brand of Australian exceptionalism and brilliance. What I argue in the book is that we're now in a new cycle of history, that exceptionalism is gone. Australia no longer leads the world. We are no longer pioneers of first best economic and social reform, and this is reflected in stagnant living standards, in weak economic reform, in substantial budget deficits, in a sense of community unhappiness. The Australian people sense something has gone wrong. Our governments are not performing. Our country is not performing, hence the twilight of Australian exceptionalism,
and
the title.
What I really admire about the first part of this book is you're trying to tackle what's underpinning this, and you talk about Australia being riven by two cultures, divided over, you say, identity, politics, climate change, minority rights, racism, environmentalism, religious freedom, Indigenous justice, migrant policy, gender relations, education values, and Australian history. It's a long list. But haven't we always been a country that's evolved or progressed on social and economic issues? Or are you saying this level of division has been something new, something different?
I'm saying the level of division now is of a different nature. And the reason it's of a different nature is the country is now more fundamentally and permanently divided. This is a division not just about values, but the disintegration of shared values, the disintegration of the shared idea of what is virtue, what is the good society. Australians now fundamentally disagree about this issue, and this, I think, is a fundamental change. The other change that I identify is what you just referred to. There are now a new set of sweeping challenges which define the 21st century. The economy is more difficult now in terms of producing economic growth. We have a very, very difficult energy transition, the like of which this country hasn't seen before. We have identity politics, a fractured society over race, religion, sex, gender. We have a technological revolution, the rise of social media, the decline of the legacy media, and finally we have a strategic challenge with the rise of China and its aspiration to be the regional hegemon. Now, when you put all these challenges together, they constitute a network of challenges which is incredibly difficult for any government to manage. And what I argue is we now have a crisis of the system. It's more difficult for governments, whether they're coalition governments or Labor governments, to deliver proper national interest policy for the country, and the electorate feels this, they sense it, and they don't like it.
I'm going to come back to what that means for the Albanese government trying to govern in that environment. But sticking with this period you're writing about, you argue that at the end of it, the 22 election, which brought the coalition era under those three prime ministers to an end, you say that election revealed the moral centre of the middle class had shifted. So here's my question for you, Paul Kelly. If the middle class had shifted, should the Liberal Party have been and still be fighting to shift that middle class back through whatever cultural or institutional or political levers it can pull? Or should it just be accepting this shift, that it's happened, that it's and that it now needs to go to where the middle class now is?
I think the task of any political party is to interpret how the nation is changing and evolving. And one of the points I argued, David, is that when Tony Abbott won the 2013 election, there was this deluded sense in the government that it was going to be business as usual, that this would be another successful John Howard-type government. But in actual fact, Australia had changed, and the Abbott government didn't sufficiently recognise that. I think what happened during the nine years of coalition government is that the coalition lost its way. It was attempting to respond to the changes going on in the country, but it was divided over what they meant. It was increasingly divided, with progressives and conservatives within the Liberal Party having different solutions as to what ought to happen. And the incredible thing was, we didn't just have three prime ministers, we had three completely different prime ministers. Mm. Tony Abbott, Malcolm Turnbull and Scott Morrison had different views about the Liberal Party, different views about the priorities of the country. What this meant was that it was very hard for the government to adjust to these changes and to devise sensible policy responses. When the government finally lost the 2022 election, the Australian people felt, well, we're now confused about the Liberal Party. Mm. We don't know what their core beliefs are anymore.
Which is still the problem.
I think it's still the problem. The electorate voted accordingly, rejecting the Morrison government. And of course, since then, this fundamental problem in terms of what are the core beliefs, the core philosophy of the Liberal Party has only deepened.
As you say, those three figures are fascinating central figures in Tony Abbott, Malcolm Turnbull and Scott Morrison during this period. They're ideologically different. They're temperamentally different as well. Let's start with Tony Abbott. What do you conclude about his strengths as a prime minister and his weaknesses as a prime minister?
Tony Abbott was a muscular prime minister. There's no doubt about that. He saw himself as a moralist. He saw himself as the most conservative leader who'd led the Liberal Party since the party's formation. But it's very difficult, and this is where Tony Abbott struggled, to translate his conservative beliefs and his conservative principles into practical action, practical policy. He was ambitious for the economy. But the first Abbott hockey budget misjudged the country, misjudged the mood of the country, and caused a ferocious public backlash. When it came to his conservative principles, whether it was free speech or attitudes towards the monarchy and the knighthood, Tony Abbott got into a tremendous trouble trying to implement these beliefs, implement these ideas. His great paradox was, Abbott was a conservative prime minister, a conservative liberal leader, but Australia was becoming a more progressive country. There was an inbuilt contradiction and tension there from the start. It was finally resolved, courtesy of the Liberal Parliamentary Party, when it removed Tony Abbott as prime minister.
One of the criticisms that he faced as prime minister from some of his colleagues, primarily Malcolm Turnbull, was his style, his management style, and the power and influence of his chief of staff, Peter Credlin, who he wouldn't sack despite the calls for him to do so. What was going on there? What does that dynamic tell us about Tony Abbott?
A couple of big points there, David. I have John Howard on the record in the book saying that Tony Abbott did not spend enough time with the colleagues. I think this is exactly correct. Howard understood, as a Liberal leader and Liberal Prime Minister, you've got to cultivate and nurse the backbench. You must cultivate and nurse the parliamentary party, because if they aren't with you, you tend to lose your job. Tony Abbott did not do that enough. The other point goes to this extraordinary partnership between Tony Abbott and Peter Credlin. And the heart of this was Tony Abbott's belief that he could only be a successful prime minister working with Peter Credlin, and his earlier belief that his success in the 2013 election, when he won the election and became prime minister, was a joint effort, a genuinely joint effort between himself and Peter Credlin. So this was a most unusual position for a prime minister to take, that his fortunes and his capacity to do the job depended upon his relationship with his chief of staff. That is most unusual, but that is one of the defining features of the Abbott prime ministership.
Despite being a muscular political figure, as you put it, was there self-doubt there? Does that explain this reliance on the partnership?
That's a great question, David, and I argue in the book there was self-doubt. I know that the common view of Tony Abbott is that he is an assertive, muscular figure. That's the image he conveyed as prime minister. But it's a misleading image, because beneath that, Tony Abbott was a very humble man. I've known every Australian prime minister since Gough Whitlam, and I argue in the book, Tony Abbott was certainly the most humble. And it was that sense of humility. The fact is that he didn't, in a personal sense, have a great ego. He wasn't a narcissist. He felt he needed Peter Credlin. And I think that psychological reality is at the heart of the Abbott story.
Malcolm Turnbull then takes the prime ministership, and he did so with broad public appeal at the time and enormous expectations. What did Malcolm Turnbull get right and what did he get wrong?
The point to make about Malcolm Turnbull is he got right his removal of Tony Abbott and becoming prime minister after 2 years. So in that sense, of course, that was an enormous achievement for Malcolm Turnbull. However, expectations about Malcolm Turnbull when he got the job were ludicrously high. I mean, we had people walking around saying he could be a great prime minister. We had various other people saying that he'll transform policy on climate change, that he'll put same-sex marriage to a parliamentary vote. None of those things were going to happen. Malcolm Turnbull wasn't an instinctive politician. He came into politics late. He was an investor, a lawyer, and a businessman. I've called him in the book an optimistic technocrat. He was a rationalist. But he wasn't equipped to lead a political party in an ideological age. And he was never able to manage the incredibly difficult situation he faced with an aggressive Labor opposition on the other side of the chamber, and then behind him, he had a very significant Conservative lobby that wanted to remove him as Prime Minister. That was a difficult situation. Enemies in front, enemies behind. It required a lot of political skill to manage that, and at the end of the day, Malcolm Turnbull lacked that skill.
I mean, he would argue, has long argued, that the big problem he faced was those enemies behind, and a large chunk of his own party being in the thrall of Sky News and Peter Credlin as part of that. I mean, does he have a point, do you think, Paul, that when it came to issues like landing a climate and energy policy, his party was under the spell of News Corp in particular?
No, I think the reality is that the Liberal Party is a broad-based party, as John Howard pointed out. So the Liberal Party is a party of moderates and progressives on the one hand and conservatives on the other hand. And of course, the Liberals govern with the National Party. So any Prime Minister, whether it's Abbott, Turnbull or Morrison, has got to be able to manage the entire party. And I think this is the reality. It was idle to expect that Malcolm Turnbull was going to be able to reinvent climate policy or take a radical progressive stand on a number of issues. That wasn't a feasible option because he had to govern for the entire party. He at the end of the day, failed to do that. One of the interesting features about his prime ministership is he was supported for a long time by the two great conservative pillars in the party, Matthias Cormann and Peter Dutton. But at the end of the day, fearing that Turnbull had lost his magic way with the electorate, fearing that he was likely to lose the next election, ultimately, they both turned against him.
And that was the end for Malcolm Turnbull. So we get to Scott Morrison, the most pragmatic of the three, it must be said. And look, he takes the leadership after Dutton failed. He pulls off the miracle election win in 2019 that Bill Shorten was expected to win. And then Morrison arguably faces the biggest headwinds of this period of coalition government with the pandemic hitting in 2020. How do you assess the Morrison prime ministership?
I think Morrison was the most significant of the three prime ministers given his achievements and given the challenges that he faced on his watch. Initially, of course, as you point out, David, he won the 2019 election. That meant the government got three terms, not two. I argue in the book that only Morrison could have won that election, that neither Peter Dutton nor Malcolm Turnbull would have won it. As Prime Minister, Morrison faced three really epic challenges. First of all, there was the campaign of trade coercion waged against the Australian government and waged against Morrison personally by Beijing. Then, of course, we had the global crisis with COVID, the global pandemic, with the threat to inflict enormous economic damage on the Australian economy, and then very severe health consequences. So the second half of Morrison's prime ministership was really devoted to meeting these external challenges. I think overall he did very well. He prevailed in terms of China's trade coercion against Australia. The Chinese had to abandon that campaign. In terms of the economic response to COVID, both Scott Morrison and Josh Frydenberg worked very well together on that. I think Australia's performance was one of the top two in terms of OECD nations. We did incredibly well in our economic response to the crisis. We did fairly well when it came to the health response, not quite as well as we did when it came to the economy, but nonetheless, in per capita terms, the number of Australian deaths wasn't nearly as severe as most other industrialised nations. So overall, I think Morrison handled these challenges quite effectively. But of course, what happened in terms of the health challenge was he carried the blame for the situation. The Labor premiers were much closer to the electorate. The electorate favoured the hardline lockdowns of the Labor premiers, and the Labor premiers won the politics of that against Morrison, and Morrison at the end of the day never recovered. So he lost the politics of COVID.
Yeah, they were all being re-elected at the state level, and he was then turfed out. Looking back at those three leaders, Paul, and if we come back to your initial point around how difficult Australia is to govern these days and how the middle class had shifted, which of these three prime ministers do you think best understood the challenges that Australia faces?
I think the answer to that, David, is that each of these prime ministers disappointed, and each of them disappointed in their own unique way. Neither of them, or none of them, I should say, were able to establish a dominance the way Bob Hawke had established a dominance as a Labor Prime Minister or John Howard as a Liberal Prime Minister. So I think the real answer to your question is there's no particular one of the three that stands out as being superior to the rest in terms of management, in terms of understanding of the Australian people. I think, as I said earlier on, the interesting thing about Scott Morrison is he handled the challenges he faced very well, but at the end of the day, he fell out very badly with the Australian people. The public turned against him in a savage way, and Morrison clearly bears a lot of responsibility for the final election defeat in 2022.
And this brings us to Anthony Albanese, the winner in 2022, and now a two-term Prime Minister with the likelihood of a third term, sitting on a big parliamentary majority. Paul, if the political model is broken, how has Anthony Albanese managed to succeed politically?
Great question, David. So one of the things that Anthony Albanese has certainly achieved, and he needs to be recognised for this, he's returned stability to the prime ministership. He's returned stability to the leadership. After this long period of instability, the Rudd-Gillard-Rudd period, followed by the Abbott-Turnbull-Morrison period, we now have a period of stability when it came to leadership under Anthony Albanese, his authority within the Labor Party, his sense of discipline and unity within the party is very conspicuous. So this is certainly an achievement. However, if we look at the second argument I've made in the book, and that second argument is that Australia is a much more difficult nation to govern now, and in particular, it's more difficult for leaders and prime ministers to deliver successful national interest policies and successful national interest reforms, then I think that argument still holds. If we look at the situation that Anthony Albanese faces today, we've got flatline productivity, stagnant living standards, falling real wages, high debt, high deficits, a crisis about the effective role of government. And I think we can see an ongoing issue here, the issue that we saw during the earlier coalition period, that it's more difficult for prime ministers to govern the country effectively. I think this is still the same story, despite the stability under this present period of Albanese government. I think the crisis of the system is still in existence.
And I want to ask you, Paul, a couple of contemporary questions, and one leads from that. You've argued, including in your column this week, that Pauline Hanson and One Nation are a political gift for Labor. You point to the way Labor's using the current polls to point out that the Liberals, the Nationals and One Nation can't govern without each other. And you can see that this is an easy script for Labor to run, that you know there will inevitably, if it's not Labor, it'll have to be a coalition of these three right-wing parties. It really is going to be the Labor songbook, as you say, at the state and federal level. Some Conservatives do want a closer alignment with between the Liberals and One Nation. Others are very wary about this. You seem to be arguing that it is a foolish strategy for the Liberals to get too close to One Nation. Why?
I certainly think that, David. And the reason I think that is, despite the degree of support that Pauline Hanson has, whether it's 20%, 25%, 28% or 29%, Hanson is still rejected in large parts of the Australian population, and in particular, she's rejected to a large extent in urban Australia. Now, if the Liberal Party is seen to be forming an alliance with Pauline Hanson or looking towards a future coalition in government with Pauline Hanson, this gives the Labor Party a wonderful argument to use against the Liberals, and that is that a vote for the Liberal Party is a vote for Pauline Hanson, and a vote for Pauline Hanson is a vote for the Liberals. Now, we've seen over the course of the last week Anthony Albanese make it absolutely clear that this is Labor's songbook for the next election. All the senior Labor figures are singing from this songbook. This is what their research tells them, and I think they're completely correct. What they're arguing is that the three parties on the centre-right of politics, the Liberals, the Nationals and One Nation, if they can be lumped together, then this is guaranteed to deliver Labor success at the next election. I think that's correct. And the reason I think it's correct is Pauline Hanson does not have any of the answers to the fundamental problems this country faces. As far as I'm concerned, she has no proper role as a future minister in a centre-right government, let alone as prime minister in a centre-right government. I think that as time goes on over the course of the next 15 months, the Hanson vote will gradually fall away as more and more people recognise she doesn't have the answers and there are serious character issues concerning Hanson.
Well, this, Paul, brings us back to one of the main characters in your book, Tony Abbott. He is now the president of the Liberal Party, and he has been doing things like echoing Hanson's position on multiculturalism. He's been talking about preference deals with One Nation. I mean, it's pretty clear that he is on the side of the Liberal Party that wouldn't mind some sort of closer arrangement. Is he heading the Liberal Party down the wrong path?
Well, to the extent that Tony Abbott is doing what you say he's doing, David, if he's actually working towards some form of arrangement between the Liberal Party and the Coalition and One Nation in government, or presenting the next election in those terms for the centre-right, then yes, I think that is a tactical and strategic mistake. I mean, there's a long way to go yet, and we'll have to see how the situation evolves. But I'm very much on the side of Angus Taylor as Liberal leader, when Taylor has made it absolutely clear that as far as he's concerned, there will be no coalition arrangement after the next election between the Liberal Party and One Nation. Look, this is an extraordinary situation, David, isn't it? I mean, Hanson is attacking the Liberal Party. Hanson is taking votes away from the Liberal Party. She's done enormous damage to the polling position of the Liberal Party. And it's surely extraordinary that you've got people in the party saying the answer to this is not to take on Hanson, but to actually engage in some form of appeasement with Hanson, or actually entertain the idea of some sort of coalition with her. But any coalition with Hanson, in which One Nation is the major party and the Liberals are the minor party, which seems to be the tacit assumption of some of these arguments, means the end of the Liberal Party. That would doom the Liberals as a governing party in this country.
Paul, it seems finally as though you're going to leave the chronicling and analysis of this period we're in the coming or the next federal election to someone else. I mean, you'll be covering it, of course, in all your weekly writings, but in a book form, in the way that you've delivered these last three books, this is it for you, the twilight of exceptionalism, you have said. Let me ask, as someone who's observed and analysed Australian politics more closely than perhaps anyone, do you despair or do you have hope about where politics in this country is going?
I've always been an optimist, David. I am very concerned about where our politics is at the moment. I'm very concerned about the situation of the country in terms of our direction. I think we're really facing enormous challenges, and I don't think at the moment that our established leaders, both in politics and in the private sector, seem to be responding with the wisdom and resolution that is required. So yes, I am concerned. Having said that, I've got a great faith in Australia. You look at our history over the last couple of hundred years. We've gone through a series of bad periods. We've always been able to recover. I think there's a certain degree of common sense and resilience in the Australian character, in the Australian people, and I hope we see that on display yet again.
I think that's a positive note to finish on. Paul Kelly, wonderful to chat to you. Congratulations on the book once again, and thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, David.
And we'll be back Sunday morning. Hope you enjoyed us for Insiders on ABC TV. PK back in the podcast feed on Monday, and we'll be back with another one of these podcasts at the end of the week. Bye for now.
You're making us all feel very excited about being here.